Good afternoon to everyone. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. A large percentage of Alaskans, it's been estimated to be about 23%, can be defined as having a disability. In addition, people with disabilities have more chronic health issues, less access to health care than those without disabilities. Today, we're going to explore the reasons for these findings, the barriers to preventing appropriate change, and what is being done to help improve these problems. My guests today are Joanne Sullivan. She's Deputy Director of Health and Wellness Support, and Michelle Giroux, who is Senior Deputy Director, both from Hope Community Resources. Also joining us is Amanda Cooper. She's the Program Manager for the State of Alaska's Health and Disability Program. If you have questions or comments that are stimulated by today's conversations, give us a call. You can reach us locally during the next hour at 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us also during this next hour at line1, that's all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at alaskapublic.org. Welcome to each of you. It's nice to have you here. One thing I do often forget to tell my guests when they're here, and we have multiple guests, is it helps to listeners to, if you identify yourself when you answer questions. I sometimes don't do that, but I think it does make it easier. So let's start, Amanda, with some description of the program the state is supporting, the Health and Disability Program. Give us some background about the rationale behind it, how the funding is doing, what you're doing. So I think it gives us some good ideas, some background for the program today.
Sure. So the Alaska Health and Disability Program started as an ad hoc committee within the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, and that was in 2012. One of their interns identified that the needs of Alaskans with disabilities, their health needs and emergency preparedness needs, there was no program that was addressing that. In 2012, Alaska Health and Disability full program began through funding from the Centers for Disease Control. It is a health and disability grant that focuses on emergency preparedness and health promotion for Alaskans with disabilities. It is a three-year grant, and we are in our final year of our first grant cycle with the option of another grant cycle that should be released later in the year.
So what that makes me think of is, in a lot of families or listeners may not be aware, I came up here with the CDC. All we did was infectious disease, some environmental occupational health issues, but now the CDC is funding a lot of work in chronic diseases, asthma and many of the other chronic diseases, but also now in disability. What's the driving idea force behind this? What's the primary premise going on?
The premise is that we are finding that Alaskans with disabilities and people with disabilities, they are facing disparities in nearly every core health indicator.
Right.
And so there is a push, and there needed to be a specific program that would address the needs of Alaskans with disabilities. While we have great overall public health programs for Alaskans, there is still, there isn't as much awareness, there isn't as much education surrounding the needs of Alaskans with disabilities. So this is, like I said, this is the first of its kind in Alaska. We are one of 18 grantees throughout the United States. So just in the 3 years that we've been going, we've conducted a statewide needs assessment to really find out what the issues are in Alaska facing Alaskans with disabilities.
All right. Michelle, you and Joanne both told me before the program you got 25 or 30 years experience in this, so I'm going to guess that you all feel like this was necessary, needed, and a long time coming. Is that true?
Absolutely. I think that through the years, we've seen a lot of changes in healthcare focus. And I think now, even more than ever before, there's a growing collaboration between healthcare providers, the nonprofit sector who provides the services and supports, and really thinking how we can increase access, increase education, and increase outcomes for people that experience disabilities.
Yeah, I mean, those are the major aims of the Accountable Care Act, is increasing access, affordability, and quality, actually. And so there's a big movement throughout this country to do that. If people don't quite get it yet, is my understanding from listening to people talk. But we could do a lot better in how we provide and perform healthcare in this country, it seems to me. And that's kind of what is the efforts that are being made. And this is just a small part of it. Joanne, you agree?
I do agree, and I see an additional facet of it, which is partnership. As resources in general, either human resources, physicians, medical professionals, caregivers, and financial resources become more and more limited, I think looking at things in a partnership way, are we sitting down with physicians or other medical professionals and saying, what would make it easier to provide health care for the people we support? And are those medical professionals or other professionals sitting down with us and saying, you know, if you just did this or if you collaborated with us on this, we could have a better product.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you're trying to do with this program, Amanda, is get all the stakeholders, as they say, at the table and see how we can collate information and disseminate information.
Absolutely. We currently, for our Alaska Health and Disability Committee, we have 37 members representing, I believe, more than 20 different state agencies, as well as private and nonprofit entities. Mm-hmm. And currently, we are in the final stages of our three-year strategic plan, which includes a very important piece of collaboration, where we have identified other agencies within the state and other nonprofits that can take on a lot of the action steps that need to be completed to improve the outcomes and improve the health of Alaskans with disabilities.
So, Joanne, Michelle, one of you tell us a little bit about HOPE resources and community resources, and let us know what you're all about. And I'm just kind of thinking as we listen to this that you're probably an organization that's been trying to, in a sense, trying to get all this going. And I mean, it is, I think, nice to have somebody, even if it's a state agency, we might argue, but I think that works better, frankly, to get everybody working together. It'll be a little bit more cost effective. We just got limited time, limited resources, but we got lots of expertise out there too. So tell us about HOPE Resources.
HOPE was created in 1968 with one woman. Her name was Nancy Stewart, who was actually taking care of children that experienced disabilities that were moved out of Fairbanks because of a flood. And from that, the impetus came from a number of members of the community that as Nancy started to, her name got out there and people said, oh, let's call Nancy about caring for this child. A nonprofit was developed. And there were a number of children. The history of Alaskans and disabilities is that kids were taken out of their homes and sent out of state to Oregon and Washington. They were brought back and went to API or Harborview Developmental Center in Valdez, or right. came from one right. institution to another, until there was really a focus on community-based programs. And part of that was really looking at what was the best for an individual to be with their family, and how do you develop rural care for individuals so they could go home or stay home or never have to leave their village. People that were born in urban centers, that's great, but they still needed access to care. So HOPE has now developed into a statewide agency. We serve 9 regions of the state, and we've gone where people have asked us to come, and we've helped individuals be able to stay in their home community, and that's come from a lot of the partnership, and Joanne can speak about that. Regarding how you support their health care in a very challenging situation. But we've had kids who people have said they can never leave the hospital, be able to go home and be successful, or they transition from hospital to urban center back to village so that they can live with their family. And that's the impetus that HOPE has really had a foundation for, is that people belong with family. They belong in their community of choice. They belong in a place where they can express their own culture. And Alaska's so diverse, and we've seen tremendous changes over the years to where kids that are born now with challenging medical conditions or health conditions, there is kind of a triage of how can we support this child so it can go back home. And Joanne can probably talk more about those specifics.
Let me ask about funding. I'm always interested. I think it's important that we let everybody know where the funding resources from guests are coming. So where does HOPE get its funding?
The primary source of funding is from Medicaid, and it's what we call the Medicaid waiver. So the waiver is basically waiving. You have to qualify for a level of medical care, nursing level of care, and you waive those. So we don't have an institution any longer. Harborview has closed down. And the primary source is the Medicaid waiver, which is a split of federal and state dollars. Some ancillary monies come from state grants, but those are relatively small compared to the waiver.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I came up here in 78, so Harborview was still in existence at
correct.
That time. And the effort has been made to move kids, maybe an adult. I don't remember about Harborview. I think it was just kids. But anyway, adult, those with disabilities out of a group home situation back into more of a home-like environment. And Medicaid saw that as an important thing to be doing and is trying to fund that.
Well, there was actually demonstration that it was more cost-effective.
Right.
That
okay.
there were fewer right. hospitalizations, okay. that the community services cost less
right.
than institutional care. So
okay.
there was a benefit to the individual on a quality of life issue, but there was also a financial yeah. benefit to those funding.
Yeah. So we grew up in an understanding of how to take care of people that needed lots of services from a one place kind of situation back into a more home-like environment, and
right.
it's beneficial for everybody.
Absolutely.
Joanne, can you add anything to that? That's pretty good.
It may be why we've been around for so long at HOPE. But we, years ago, probably 20 years ago, when we closed the ICFMRs, the Intermediate Care Facilities for the Mentally Retarded, those facilities were staffed with lay staff as well as nurses 24/7. And we pretty quickly found that when you move people into the community, they don't need nursing nearly as much. They don't need a lot of medical care. We have two types of community nursing teams at this point. One team that works mainly with adults who have long-term disabilities, and one team that works with children with complex medical conditions. Excuse me. And what we always tell our nurses is, you're not here to be the expert and tell somebody what they need. You're here to listen to what they think they need. Because regardless of the person receiving medical care, if they are invested in it, if they feel like they're participating in it, it's going to go much better. It's going to be much more successful. So our goal is to help people be successful in the community of their choice. And that takes many different portraits, I guess you want to say, of, you know, when you have somebody who's living off the grid in a village and you're trying to help them with a child who may have respiratory issues, equipment issues, you know, do you send all this equipment out? And perhaps the parents can't afford the electricity that it takes to run this equipment. What we found, though, is generally if you say to the person involved and their family or their support team, what do you need for health care? They've got a pretty good idea. It often comes down to education, affordability, and accessibility. So do people, they know they want to feel healthy. Do they know how to eat healthy? Has somebody helped them be educated along the lines of what is a healthy way to eat? And then can they afford it? Organic food is much more expensive than non-organic food in general, but can you help people perhaps buy with other people in their community so that they can cut down on the cost? And then accessibility. If you can only walk to the 7-Eleven, are you going to get a lot of organic fresh produce there? Or do you need to be on a bus system? Do you need to have somebody partner with you to help you grocery shop? So, and there's other aspects of healthcare that those three criteria affect.
How would you prioritize those three? Number one, number two, number three, in your experience?
I would say education first, accessibility second, and affordability third, because if you can access it, many times there's a way that you can find a way to afford it or partner with somebody. But if you don't know that, you know, Cheetos aren't as good a food source as perhaps fresh vegetables are, you may not even be exploring those topics.
Let me remind listeners, we're talking about the health aspects in general of individuals with a disability. Up to this point, we've talked about how the state is beginning to use federal grant money to advocate for better care of the total health care of people with disabilities. And we're also listening to representatives from HOPE Community Resources about their efforts to have been doing this since the 60s, you said.
68, right.
Since 1968. I'm sure there are listeners out there that have experiences. They have their own patient experiences or family experiences. And if you have comments or questions about what you're hearing, let me encourage you to call. Let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So this is an open question to any of you that want to try to answer it. I'm sure that others, when they heard me make the introduction that about 23% of our population have a disability, wondered about that number in one way or the other. I certainly said, gosh, that seems like a high percentage. So let's put some better description of what we're talking about with disabilities and where that number comes from.
So this is Amanda. The number 23, it's actually 23.8 of Alaskans report having a disability. And that data comes from the State of Alaska Behavioral Health Risk Factor Surveillance System, or surveillance survey that is given every year. The reason those numbers can look quite high is that the BRFIS only asks two questions related to disability. And they are extremely broad questions. One asks about, do you have any physical, mental, or emotional issue that prevents you from living your daily lives, any limitations. The second one asks if you use any sort of special equipment, such as a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So they're extremely broad, and we have to remember that this definition includes not only disabilities from birth, but also include age-related disabilities, temporary disabilities, acquired disabilities. So it is a rather broad definition, but when it comes down to it, at one point in time, nearly a quarter of Alaskans have a disability.
Yeah, so that makes more sense when you define. That's what I wanted to get across. So someone who's disabled for a short period of time because of a severe motor accident might be disabled for a year or two because of their inability to get around.
Right.
And somebody who has a disability that later in life with Alzheimer's disease is versus somebody with Down syndrome or cerebral palsy from birth or something. So there's
correct.
Yeah. All right. So another way to look at this, I guess, would be to ask, and I don't know if Amanda or Michelle or Joanne is the right one, what are the major disabilities that realistically you all are dealing with or are trying to address? I know there's a broad spectrum. We just described that. Mm-hmm. But I'm assuming that in most bell-shaped or most biological system, there's a whole bunch of things in the middle, and then there's a few outliers out there. So what are the things we're dealing with most of the time when we talk about disabilities as we're discussing them today?
I think in terms of HOPE, the primary probably is an intellectual disability, so something existing from birth. Some of the greatest incidences we're seeing right now are individuals experiencing autism, and that's a wide spectrum. We also have a small component, but growing on dealing with people who are dually diagnosed. So they have an intellectual disability as well as some mental health support needs. We have a number of individuals who experience fetal alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol effect, which is probably a higher incidence in Alaska than some other states. And then we're not seeing as much, Joanne can probably speak to, you know, young kids with complex medical conditions, that what we're seeing there.
This is Joanne, and we do see many more children born perhaps prematurely who survive or born with a particular type of birth defect or some sort of syndrome where in 20 years ago, the parents would have been told there isn't really anything we can do for your child, and yet those children are surviving at this point, sometimes with time-limited disabilities and sometimes with permanent disabilities.
I can't help but want to ask this question. Joanne, I'm going to ask you, and maybe the right person is going to be Michelle, but I think you told me you've been at this longer, and there's this constant issue in my mind, so this is a very jealous question or very unilateral, and that's, has the incidence of autism really changed? You're smiling at me. I hope I'm not putting you in a spot, but there's a general feeling we're seeing a lot more autism. And the problem is identification. There is, what do we call autism? We've broadened the spectrum. We've recognized it where we didn't recognize it before. And this is in my lifetime in the last 30 years. And I'm always remembering a study I read where in England they took people using today's diagnostic criteria, and they looked at people by decades of life, 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, 20, 40 to 50, up through 60 to 70, I think. And in all of those decades of life, it was about 1%, which is about where we are right now, suggesting, one, it's not immunizations, which there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that, but that using today's diagnostic criteria, it hasn't changed in England in 70 years. What you've been around, you mentioned autism. What's your experience? How do you think about this problem?
Well,
make the diagnosis more often.
Make the diagnosis more often. And I think some of that is just education and awareness. I think also some of it is society. I believe larger classroom sizes lead to less tolerance of differences with children. I have to say, I went to a one-room schoolhouse, and we had 5 kids in the grade, you know. So everybody was a different individual, and you knew who could sit still and who could do this and who could do that. So there's almost a fear at this point that you hear about autism so often that 50% of people born this year are going to have autism. And I don't know that we find it's that significant, but we definitely find more families coming to us with a child who has a diagnosis of autism and asking, are there ways that we can help support that family? You see more parents where both parents in the family work. Mm-hmm. So 20 years ago, would one of those parents been home with a child who today would be diagnosed with autism, and they would just say, this child is very busy, and they would adapt their family that way. The other thing that's interesting to me is adults that we have provided supports to for years who are suddenly saying, maybe I have been experiencing a mild form of autism or Asperger's syndrome, and that connects the dots for me.
Right.
Who is the British singer, Susan Boyle,
said,
at last I feel normal in my own world. So I don't have any statistics to say it's not occurring more often or just as often.
Yeah. Well, there's experts that argue it. I just I'm always the skeptic, and I just wonder, for a lot of the reasons you've explained already, it can get kind of muddled, and there are a lot of other reasons. One is funding. For schools get funding based on certain diagnostic criteria. Kids get help, and so lots of things can affect these things. Comments, Michelle?
Well, it's interesting because I've never been one to really focus on the individual diagnosis.
Yep. Okay, good point.
So, and we've always just really struggled on how do you teach that particular child, because if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Right.
So everybody's an individual, and I think throughout our history at Hope is just individualizing the teaching, the learning styles, because that's so varied. You know, all three of us sitting here have a different learning style. And I think that we're seeing, as Joanne said, we're seeing more diagnostics coming through. But at the end of the day, you just figure it's an individual. We have to figure out how to meet their particular needs, whether it's how they learn within a teaching environment or how they access their health care. It's individualized supports.
Yeah, and it's I think most of us in providing health care, and including all these organizations like Hope Community Resources and everybody who's given these services, we recognize that the diagnosis is not that important. It's meeting the needs of the individuals. However, the parents often want a diagnosis.
Just give me a name, right? Give
me help a name. Me with that. And that, and especially with neurologic illnesses, it can be difficult, and especially because there's such a variety. Right now, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me that the whole framework of autism is going to be multiple different diseases with multiple different genetic origins and sources. There's just a huge number of genes that are being associated with this problem, which is almost certainly where the issue arises. Well, I've took my editorial prerogative and got off the topic here for just a second. But I think this is probably an appropriate time to take our mid-break. And then what I'm going to do when we come back, we'll start talking about some of the health issues and the problems why the health issues may be there with individuals with disability greater than in the general public. So let me remind everybody once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short, roughly 1 minute break, we'll continue our discussion on health and disability with Joanne Sullivan, Michelle Giroux, and Amanda Cooper. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Joanne Sullivan. She's Deputy Director of Health and Wellness Service Support, and Michelle Giroux. She's the Senior Deputy Director at both of those individuals are from Hope Community Resources. They're in the studio with me, and also along with Amanda Cooper. Amanda is the program manager for the State of Alaska Disability Program. Up to this point, we've kind of described the issue of disabilities and what each of these organizations are all about. And now we're going to talk about a little bit more about how the health of individuals with disabilities differs and why that might be and what we might be able to try to do about that. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us over the next roughly 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. If you get the idea to touch base with us on a program you're listening to between 9 and 10, we will not be here. That's a taped rebroadcast. One more thing before we open the program. I have a bit of very sad news to report, and that is that Tom Magliozzi, he is one of the Click and Clack brothers who produced the Car Talk program for a number of years on NPR, passed away this morning from complications of Alzheimer's disease. He was, I'm sure, a person well-known to people who listen to NPR. The program, as I understand it, will continue from the recent past. It's been rebroadcast in copies of programs, possibly because Tom was already suffering somewhat. I remember him and his brother Ray well because they did a program once about coincidence and causality and people who brought their cars into them with problems, and they jumped to the conclusion that because something happened close in sequence to it, it must be the cause. That's a common problem in medicine as well. Just because you get an immunization and your kid later has got autism, it doesn't mean it's the immunization. And there are zillions of things like that. I was very appreciative of their wisdom about addressing that and even tried to get them to come on the program. With no success. So I'm really sad to hear that. It was a great program, and I hope it will continue to be broadcast in some way on NPR for a number of months, if not years. Okay, so back to us. What do we know about individuals with disabilities and their general health needs and problems compared to the rest of us, the people without disability? I'll say I don't have a disability. I'm not sure that's true. But.
So this is Amanda. We have found through the data that we currently have, there are huge disparities between Alaskans with disabilities and Alaskans without. Some of the largest disparities are around disabilities that are preventable, such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, lung cancer. So when it comes to Alaskans with disabilities, currently more than 72% of Alaskans with disabilities are considered either overweight or obese based on their BMI, which is compared with about 23% of Alaskans without disabilities, or excuse me, 64% of Alaskans without disabilities. We also know that nearly 30% of Alaskans with disabilities are current tobacco users. Based on recent data, about 40% of Alaskan adults with disabilities report that currently their general health is either fair or poor. That's their overall health over a 30-day period. So we're finding that there are some significant health issues, and the overall health of Alaskans with disabilities is definitely not where it should be, and is definitely there's more room for improvement with Alaskans with disabilities versus Alaskans without disabilities.
Michelle, you and Joanne have worked directly with individuals with disabilities for a long time. Does that dovetail or jive with your experiences?
Well, we happen to be, the folks that we work with usually have a funding source. So what we see challenges, and Joanne can add to this, is one, accessibility, because not all medical providers will take Medicaid, which is usually the primary source of healthcare funding for individuals. Depending on where people are living, their access to providers, their need for support to get to that provider, their need for education to understand when they might need to get in and be asking some questions. So it really is a varied scale of people and their individual needs that can potentially produce barriers for them.
Mm-hmm. Joanne?
I would have to say that I think understanding and follow through are two big issues, both for the general population, but perhaps more so for people with disabilities. Do you understand what your medication regime should be? Do you understand how to get it? Do you understand what to do when your prescription runs out and the pharmacy says, we don't have any refills, and you're trying to get through to the doctor's office? But also accessibility, not just in finding a provider, but physically getting to the provider. If you don't have a driver's license and you don't have a car, I don't think it surprises anybody that Alaska doesn't win awards for the depth of their public transportation. So you do have anchor rides, you do have the people mover, but what if you go to the doctor's office and the bus is late and they say, no, you can't have your appointment anymore, then you have to go back. And then when you're done with the appointment, the rest of us may drive to the pharmacy and use the drive-through and get our medication, but what if you have to get a different bus to go get your medication? What if you don't have any cash on hand? So accessibility, follow-through, and continuity of healthcare. If you're working with one medical professional and they think you should call another medical professional and have a referral to them, is there staff that helps you? Does your family help you? Are you able to do it yourself? I think also making informed decisions. An informed decision just doesn't mean somebody informed you of the information. It means you need to be able to understand it, and not only understand it, but understand the long-term ramifications of it. If you choose this today, does that work out well for today? But 3 years down the road, you're going to have significant problems. And all of that takes extra time, not only for the individual with the disability, but for medical providers as well, who are often short of office time if you have to spend twice as much time explaining something or communicating to somebody. How can we help minimize that impact both on the patient and the provider?
Would it make sense to the two of you and that there are also increased risks among individuals with disabilities for some of the common problems that Amanda has discussed, like obesity and diabetes and some of the maybe joint complaints that all kind of run together? And the reason I ask that is I was just looking at some information before I came here, and there was some pretty good research suggesting that kids with autism are getting less exercise. Kids with Down syndrome, I'm going to guess, again, I don't have this one, are similar. They may not be exercising much, so their consequences are going to be overweight a little bit more and suffer consequences with it. Does that make sense to those of you who are out there involved with kids like this?
Well, we've seen that. I think that kids that experience autism may not feel comfortable in places where there are large crowds. So you go to a basketball game or want to play basketball, that's going to be pretty overwhelming for a child that maybe experiences autism. So computer work is maybe more a game of choice. And I think, the obesity issues for kids that are sitting down on couches and playing games is kind of crosses the whether you have a disability or not. But we've seen that we can take intervention on that. So we've got a hip-hop group that kids, teenagers who experience disabilities are part of. Several of them have, Down syndrome. But just doing things that are normal within your age group, dancing and skiing and offering opportunities for people help kind of address some of those issues. So providing access to opportunities, adaptive type of physical education, gets people out doing things where they might need support otherwise to do it.
Joanne, you'd mentioned that one of the group of movie theaters has actually set aside a special night for individuals that might benefit from being with a similar group, and then you can control the environment a little bit better as well.
Century Theaters has stepped up to the plate, I think about 2 years ago now, Michelle. And they have nights that essentially people who have audiovisual overload issues, with the screen being brightly lit and things flying at you and the rest of the theater is dark and you're not allowed to get up and move around. They have these theater nights where families, perhaps with children who experience autism or adults who have some issues, can go, and the lights are dim, but the theater isn't black. The noise is turned down on the screen a bit so that it's not quite in your face. And it's permissible to get up and move around if you need to. And families have really embraced that and said it's a wonderful opportunity for both the individual with a disability and the rest of the children or the rest of the family members who don't experience that disability to go out together.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, we have a caller. Maureen, you're on line one.
Hi. I've been working in and out of behavioral health, so I'm following, the need to basically web into community kind of stuff. And the severity and the complex nature of these cases. The thing I was wondering if y'all could comment briefly would be, what kind of education would, if I'm thinking that there's a lot of different roles for paying jobs in this state too, in this field. So if you could speak a little bit about that, about what do you tell somebody going to college? Here, study this, or go to this certificate program, or whatever, to work with the population that you're talking about.
All right, so you're looking at it from the education of professionals who will then in turn help these individuals, not necessarily the education of those with the disability.
Well, yeah, because you're talking about a quarter of the population, and probably, I don't know, a third of them are in need of services to the point that there's multi-agency teams.
Okay.
So you're talking about social workers, and you're talking about, educators, or you're talking about people who I don't know, Hope could probably talk about what kind of people that they have. And there's also, folks from the state there. So,
So what's the need?
You really want to study it, and you're looking at a job eventually in this field.
Yeah, what are the needs that you guys see?
I'm going to get off so I can hear you.
You bet. Thanks for your call. Amanda, you want to try this one?
Absolutely. So when someone's looking at a career working with individuals with disabilities, there are several you know, disciplines or educational areas that could assist in that type of profession. Definitely psychology, social work are huge components. You know, I would like to mention that, unfortunately, I feel that the educational opportunities are lacking when working with specific disabilities. There's not a lot of education and awareness going on in the schools. There are some courses I know that focus on educating about the population, but I think, you know, understanding complex medical needs, understanding, you know, the processes that we go through and understanding the different types of disabilities, I think will be the best preparation.
Okay. Other thoughts?
This is Michelle. I think that it's interesting. We've really tried to focus for staff that are thinking about doing things is really, do you love to teach? Do you love do you love physical education or adaptive physical education, occupational therapy, physical therapy, whatever discipline you want to get into? It's really just demanding the educational system address diversity issues, because we have such a diverse population. We have different cultures that need to be spoken to in a different mm-hmm. way, not just mm-hmm. in language, but what's their priority. So I think that if you have an interest in anything, really, you can adapt that to those that experience disabilities, and so that you have really holistic outreach to community, period, and you're not separating people that experience disabilities. So we've addressed that with trying to have education in physical things that we do with incorporating different adaptations for people that everyone can participate. For instance, we have a subsistence program, and you could say, well, somebody who's visually impaired cannot go hunting. Well, we found a way to do it. So we've had skilled guides that work with people who have visual impairments that are Alaskans who love to hunt, who still, you know, are able to go hunting. Yeah. So you really just adapt the activity to the individual need, and that, so you can really pretty much take your love and passion and apply it to people that experience disabilities.
I was just listening to the ex-governor of New York who's blind, who played golf. Anyway.
Yeah.
So and this is Joanne, and I think one of the things we need to focus on is getting more awareness and knowledge about people's disabilities and the fact that a person with disabilities has the same wants and desires and needs that people without disabilities do out into any of the human service or medical professions. We have partnered with AvTech to have their nursing students come and work with people at Hope during their practicums. Also UAA, so their nursing students come and spend time. And sometimes they say to us, wow, I never really spent any time with a person who experiences a disability, and they're just like me. Physicians get very little, from what I understand, in general. In 7 years of medicine, they might get a one-hour class on disabilities. And so what do you say to a new physician who's opening an office and you say, we want to bring in somebody who doesn't use the type of language that you use and may require some additional accommodations and may require some additional time? And will that physician be open to that? So I think if you're looking for a profession to look towards, whether it be professional or semi-professional, anything in the human services area or the medical professions, and then look at how you want to adapt that to work with people who may be less of a served population.
Good answer. Yeah. I mean, you put this whole thing in perspective when you answered it in that way. Thank you very much. Anna, you're on line one.
Hi. I have a question and concern. 23% of a population being disabled is huge, and I'm going to round that up to call it a 0.25%. I'm wondering why one quarter of our population is disabled. What are we doing wrong? Are we like the Romans drinking lead, you know? My concern is whether we are getting too much chemicals, or are we getting too much GMO, or is it our air we breathe? Is it genetic damage that's occurring because of our lifestyles? I would like to see some substantial funds being placed into finding out why our people are becoming disabled. And it's all well and good that we attend to the needs of the disabled, but I would like to reduce that population considerably and put some time and effort into not just taking care of disabled people and making sure that they're happy and live full lives like the rest of us, but who are not disabled, theoretically, but also figure out what's causing this disability to increase. Consider autism is way out of line, and ADHD and all these things. We need to be focusing on what is causing this and addressing those problems so that we don't have a continuing increase in the percentage of disabled people. And thank you. I'd love to know if anybody has any ideas on that.
Okay, thanks for your call. I'm going to start, and then I think I'll turn it back to you, Amanda, because you really kind of addressed this. There's a number of answers. We've kind of answered it when we talked about autism. I don't know. First off, just because there are a large number of people with disability does not mean the rate of disability is increasing. The same thing is true with autism. There are those who believe autism has increased. As we discussed earlier on the program, there may not be any increase. There's some evidence to suggest that it's just we're better at diagnosing it. We've broadened the diagnosis. We've changed the diagnosis. So I don't think it's necessarily true that we are seeing more disabilities. And I'm going to let Amanda tell us a little bit about why the number is high. We've asked that question already in the program earlier. There is lots of research going into why things are happening. And, in fact, many disabilities have decreased over time, which is not the purpose of this program. One that comes to mind in particular is cerebral palsy. All right, Amanda.
So actually, from the 2009-2011 data from the BRFIS to our current data, the rate of disability among Alaskans has actually decreased. It's been a minor decrease, but it has actually decreased. And when we're looking at why the rate of disability is so high, I would say that a lot of that goes into a lot of this is related to preventable disabilities, such as, there's risk factors associated. If you are not going to exercise and you're not going to eat healthy, the consequences of that are, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and that the chances of you developing those sorts of disabilities are going to increase. So we have to look at the risk factors. That's where a lot of these disabilities, that's what's driving them. If you have an individual who has a substance abuse problem, they have alcoholism, and that person decides to, that person is pregnant and has a child, that's a disability and that child has fetal alcohol spectrum. That is a preventable disability that could have been prevented with the mother. So when we're looking at the rate of disabilities, we need to remember that I don't have a certain specific number of those that are preventable, but I know that quite a large percentage of the rate of disability can be prevented.
Yeah, I had that as one of my questions. It's an extremely difficult answer to address is what the percentage is preventable. But there's lots of people looking at that information. Speaking about the broadening idea of disability and an issue that is becoming more and more of an awareness to the general public and those involved in healthcare are mental health issues, and particularly depression, anxiety, substance abuse. And so if you were just to think about that as a disability and a problem, you might ask, do people with disabilities have that same risk? And if so, is that risk better or worse? So I'm going to take a guess that it's worse within people with disabilities, but I don't know the answer to that. Anybody want to answer that question? I mean, and I'm sure it's being addressed and looked at to some degree.
I think it's Michelle, and I think that we certainly see people who are dually diagnosed. People mm-hmm. are people, mm-hmm. so they all have equal access to challenges. People in Alaska have maybe a higher incidence of being affected by the dark, being affected by isolation. The challenge with mental health interventions are that there are not many providers that are skilled to help somebody therapeutically that has an intellectual disability and also a mental health challenge. So there are definitely providers looking at that? We at HOPE are certainly looking at how you can blend that to effectively support somebody who's having a mental health challenge as well as already experiencing an intellectual disability.
It's become, I'm going to get on my soapbox just a little bit here. It's become increasingly aware that a lot of mental health issues in all of us, including adults, have their origins in the first several years of life. I won't get into all the rationale behind that, but what pediatricians are increasingly aware of is identifying those. One of the problems we have in this state is that there is very little in the way of Medicaid reimbursement and coverage for those individuals with mental health needs that don't have a psychiatrist on site. And so there are payment issues and access issues. All of this comes back again in a big way to address that. And then we talk about people with disabilities, a child who is born with spina bifida or has Down syndrome or Asperger's even. They all have the same potential risk for those mental health issues that we've talked about. And if we could address those earlier and more effectively, it makes sense that that would be a cost savings over time. I understand the need for evidence, but I think it makes pretty good sense to address that. So what we're doing here today is making people aware, trying to make people aware that they all have these disabilities. But there are a lot of barriers to this, and I wanted to bring up this one because it's beginning to be addressed. I don't want to make it sound it's impossible, but there are a number of individuals trying to affect that issue of payment for mental health services without the requirement of having a psychiatrist on staff, which is, there's not that many psychiatrists
That's a fact, yes.
So we need, and we have plenty of people who have the ability to address the issues without having a psychiatrist involved, medical social workers, counselors, and so forth.
This is Joanne, and I think for a long time there's been almost a reverse discrimination in people in the mental health field and people who are responsible for funding payment for services in the mental health field, almost saying, well, it's the intellectual disability that's the problem, not a mental health issue. I mean, we've actually been told in previous years, well, they have Down syndrome, they can't be schizophrenic as well. So, an intellectual disability isn't something that you treat. And a mental health issue is something that can be treated if you can't get the professionals or the payment sources to acknowledge that this person may have more than one issue. Right. Just having an intellectual disability does not mean that you don't have any other, that you're not diabetic or that you don't have a mental health issue. Right. And I think people are starting to come around. Again, how many programs are there for mental health professionals as they're going through their education that have any component of working with people with intellectual or physical disabilities?
And this is Amanda. I just want to make a note and point out that, having a mental health disability, mental health can be is also a primary disability, and it's also can be a secondary disability. Yeah. So
it's no different than having diabetes.
Absolutely.
Or Asperger's.
Absolutely. So right. I think we sort of need to catch up with the realization that having a mental health disability is just as important right. as having a physical disability. And when you treat an individual with a disability, when you treat them for their primary disability, you also need to remember, or there also needs to be the understanding that you can't just treat that disability, you have to treat the whole person. So mm-hmm. if you have a person mm-hmm. that does have Down syndrome, remember exactly like Joanne said, there's a chance they could have depression, so you need to screen for that. That's something that we've come across that we find is very important.
So if you had somebody with schizophrenia, you had diabetes, you'd treat their diabetes. If you have someone with diabetes that's schizophrenia, you might have trouble getting their schizophrenia treated or addressed, maybe. I don't know if that's fair to say, but similar. I mean, there's
right.
It's the same issue.
It's the whole person,
and
right.
And we've not been appropriately aware of the fact that people with disabilities have the same health needs and access and accountability.
Right.
That's basically what we're talking
right.
about here. I threw in when we were discussing what to talk about before the program is patient engagement. Another thing that's happening in primary care and is trying to figure out ways to get the patient more engaged in health. Certainly medical professionals have been guilty and accused of working only on the illness and not prevention. But in fact, there's a big change. The acute infectious disease issues are resolving. We're getting more into chronic disease. These are often things we can prevent. But to prevent them, we've got to get engagement of families. What does that mean to those of you who are dealing with people with disabilities when I say patient engagement or family engagement? What are your thoughts?
This is Michelle. I think I can speak to one example. We started an initiative at HOPE called the Healthy Lifestyles Initiative to really get primarily adults engaged in looking at how they can live a healthier lifestyle. So there were cooking classes implemented, and everybody, many people love to cook, but cooking in a way that when they were going back to their own apartments, they could make good decisions. And then an exercise room was set up. One particular man we worked with partnered with a really good friend of his, and they walked together on the treadmill. So building relationship into those choices was really important.
Yep, good. So is that something different than we used to do 25 years ago?
Yes, I think 25 years ago, people used to say, you need to do this. I wrote it down for you. Take it home and do it. And we spoke briefly prior to the show starting that Alaska has so many different cultures that you really have to be attentive to the aspects of how health is viewed in that culture. Are you instructing somebody to do something that is foreign to them, or they don't know how to do it, or they don't see the value in it, and then it becomes a failure, and then the provider says, well, you didn't do what I told you to do. You'd be better if you did do what I told you to do. And aside from disabilities, many of us have the same issues of either dealing with obesity or smoking or having one too many glasses of whatever in the evening. You also have to, I think, be attentive to how do you help people understand the message that you're trying to get across, aside even from culturally, when you're working with people with developmental disabilities or they're hearing impaired or they're vision impaired? It's very easy sometimes to say, well, if you experience total blindness, we understand we can't hand you a piece of paper that has your instructions on it unless we modify that in some way. But are we looking at other issues for somebody who has a mental health disability? Do they need to have somebody they can connect with and say, gosh, you know, I didn't do what I was supposed to do today, or I didn't take my meds? And I think there's a lot more programs. There's even an ad by one of the national chains of pharmacies out currently that says most people forget to take their meds. So they've got some sort of program, I think, that texts you or dings you in the morning and says, don't forget to take your meds. That has nothing to do with whether you have a disability or not. People are starting to recognize what are the roadblocks to keep you from being successful with being healthy. And it can only benefit people who experience a disability as well.
All of us will benefit. Healthcare costs hopefully will go down, which could be helpful. My thanks to today's guests, Joanne Sullivan, Michelle Giroux, and Amanda Cooper. If you'd like to continue this conversation on health issues for individuals with disability, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week's program is about viral infections. So if you have questions about these related illnesses, chickenpox, shingles, herpes, and mono, I bet you didn't think they were related, or even Ebola, or perhaps an illness that you may have heard is spreading in the Caribbean called chikungunya virus, then the next program is for you. Our guest will be infectious disease specialist Dr. Ben Wesley. So tune into your health next Monday. Pat Yak is chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.